From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
For decades, open borders have allowed drugs and gangs to pour into our most vulnerable communities.
President Trump's vision on immigration. Will ask Congressman Richard Neal what he makes of the president's plan for immigration reform. Also, Massachusetts has picked the Northern Pass hydropower project, but not everyone in New Hampshire is pleased.
If you pick a lot of small projects and some of them don't make it, that's much less problematic than one large project that runs into terrible difficulties and cost overruns.
Plus,
they're all good, they're all special.
Aw, is Bill Belichick handing out participation trophies?
They're all good, they're all special.
Nope, that's the Pats head coach waxing nostalgic about his past Super Bowl wins as he looks forward to Super Bowl 52. That's all next on Radio Boston.
They're all good, they're all special.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's start today with reaction from a member of the Massachusetts delegation to President Donald Trump's State of the Union address last night, specifically to what the president had to say about immigration.
For decades, open borders have allowed drugs and gangs to pour into our most vulnerable communities. They've allowed millions of low-wage workers to compete for jobs and wages against the poorest Americans. Most tragically, they have caused the loss of many innocent lives.
The president did offer what he called a four-pillared plan for immigration reform, including a pathway to citizenship for 1.8 million undocumented young people. Then Trump also said this.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream. Because Americans are dreamers, too.
Well, let's get some reaction from Congressman Richard Neal. He's the dean of the New England Congressional Delegation, and he represents Massachusetts' 1st Congressional District, which, of course, covers parts of Western Massachusetts. And he joins us today from Springfield. Congressman Neal, welcome back to the show.
Oh, glad to be with you.
Did you hear any room for negotiation on immigration from the president's
speech? Well, hopefully, when I started out in this work, one of the things that you did, you used the opening statements to outline a position, and then you figured out how you were going to get to the goal line. So if there is some room here to negotiate, we're going to quickly find out. But I think there are a couple of items that really have to be set straight. One, the largest problem that we have with people who are undocumented in America is that it comes from the idea that they actually request in their native countries a visa for holiday or vacation. Mm-hmm. And then they overstay the visa and don't go back. So the idea that all of a sudden you still have people pouring over the Mexican border is simply inaccurate, largely because of the fact that last year more people returned to Mexico than have come to America. And at the same time, we all agree that you certainly should know who's inside of the country. And individuals who are convicted, for example, of a felony should be deported. But what we're talking about here is some compromises that aren't based upon the idea that your opening position is your closing position. So I could see some room here. I think that we could move on with some incremental steps that might build some confidence so that we can get to what really needs to be done, and that is comprehensive immigration reform.
Okay, so let's talk about that a bit more then, because the president last night described, as we said, this four-part plan, right? The pathway to citizenship for about 1.8 million young people, more funding for a southern border wall, an end to family-based immigration, and the visa lottery system as well. And he wanted to move to a merit-based immigration system as well. And here's how the president described his four pillars.
These four pillars represent a down-the-middle compromise and one that will create a safe, modern, and lawful immigration system. For over 30 years, Washington has tried and failed to solve this problem. This Congress can be the one that finally makes it happen.
So, Congressman Neal, I wanted to ask you about the specific language the president used, about this being a down-the-middle compromise, because I know a lot of immigration advocates don't see it at all as down-the-middle. They see it as a continuation of the president's nativist hard-line stance on immigration.
Well, it certainly, I think, sounds, as it did last evening, as though there's some intransigence to his commentary. And I think there's broad agreement, for example, to increase economic growth in America, to increase productivity, and to increase job opportunity, that we need more immigration. I think that that would be verified by most mainstream economists. The problem is that the president seems to target a couple of areas, and then he uses that as the example of what's wrong. And I think that we all would agree that you could use more skilled people coming to the country. I think one of the tragedies of our current system is, particularly in a place like Boston, where you have these terrific young people that come from across the globe to be educated in some of the finest academic institutions in the world, and after a period of time, upon graduation, they are sent back to their native lands, where I think holding on to them makes a good deal of sense, and I think actually that would be part of a middle ground solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let me ask you about a challenge which I think that it seems that the Democratic Party might face here, right? Because I go back to what we played the president having said earlier, that he talked about, in his words, open borders, allowing drugs and gangs to cross into the United States, and millions of low-wage workers. These are the president's words. And most tragically, these open borders having caused the loss of many innocent lives. Now, that was all in one paragraph that the president uttered last night. And the reason why I wanted to bring that up again is because, to my ear, he's lumping in all sorts of things with legal immigration. And once again, going back to this notion that it's a source of a great amount of crime. I mean, it's that characterization of immigrants as a whole, which members of the Democratic Party really chafe against and may make any kind of negotiation rather difficult, isn't it?
Well, firstly, I think it's important to remember that immigrants, whether they're documented or undocumented, they participate in crime at lower rates than Americans who have, in some instances, been here for generations.
Absolutely. I mean, the president's just wrong about immigrants being higher crime.
On that. There's no doubt about it. The second thing is, if you look at the waves of immigration that took place to America from the 1850s, for example, when the first immigrants came from Ireland based upon the famine, and you look at the successive wave of immigrants that came, they were quickly absorbed into a manufacturing economy, an industrial economy. And America needed their input in terms of labor to grow. And that is not much different today when you consider that when you look at who files for patents in America today, I believe one-third of the individuals that file for patents in this country today are immigrants. I was just reading a terrific story about Enrico Fermi, for example, and he turned the world upside down, literally. He was an Italian immigrant. So I think that there's always been a certain tension in American history, despite our proclamation that we are welcoming to immigrants. There's been that bit of a who's next, who's coming in. But you know what? In a generation or two, the individuals seem to be absorbed into the American economy,
mm-hmm.
and they move on with the same sense and sort of values that the rest of us have. But this constant portrayal of immigrants to America as being the source of big crime is really not true.
I just wonder if that makes it harder for Democrats who like you want to see if there's room for negotiation to when it comes time to actually sit down and perhaps hammer out some kind of compromise, it might be more difficult because many of their own constituents are not going to want to see the party compromise at all with this president.
Well, I think that you can't have the 11 million people here that are here today living in the shadows and not sense the urgency to provide them with some regularized status or at least a path forward. I thought when President Obama said, register and get in line, that made an enormous amount of sense. But I don't think the threat of deportation, if one registers, ought to be hanging over your head. I mean, the individuals that we're talking about here with DACA, they have committed no crimes or they would be deported. When he spoke of MS-15 last night, we're all in favor of deporting gang members that have participated in violent crime.
MS-13.
But to link that to the depiction that this really is the face of immigration is simply not true.
Final question for you. We just got under a minute here, Congressman. you know, there's been a lot of focus, of course, on the president and his State of the Union. But let's not forget that that continuing resolution that got passed a couple of weeks ago was only going to keep the government open for some 3 weeks. So we're fast approaching another major deadline here. I mean, what kind of things on the immigration front do you think could happen before a potential government shutdown again comes front and center?
Well, if I were offering a hunch, I would think that the Republican majority in the House and the Senate, they will offer another continuing resolution. The problem with this is that you are now 5 months in to this year, and there's no budget. So the fiscal year started in October, so we keep doing these CRs, and it's a very bad way to do government. And I think that it should be known and acknowledged that this has now really gone on for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the constant polarization and incendiary rhetoric has not been helpful to getting America a budget on time and in line with what happened when I first came to Congress.
Well, Congressman Richard Neal represents Massachusetts First, speaking to us today from Springfield. Great to have you, Congressman. Thank
you
so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's take another look or a different look at another part of the president's State of the Union address last night, because towards the end, the president called for unity.
This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream.
But if indeed this is a new American moment, it feels like an awfully divided one, because Americans, 2-1, believe that President Trump has divided the country since his election. That's 61% to 32% believe that, according to an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll from earlier this month. So let's talk about the impact the president's first year has had on the cultural fabric of the country. And joining me now to do so is Tricia Rose. She's a professor and director of Brown University's Center of, for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Professor Rose, it's great to have you back.
Hey, great to be here.
So if indeed this is a new American moment, in the president's words, how would you describe what this moment is?
Well, it's a tragic return to a much more explicit and long history in American society of fear and race baiting and racial hierarchy. I mean, you know, you can't, the racialization of the southern border of the United States is critical to this whole immigration conversation and the culture it's fomenting. I mean, remember, when he talks about people pouring over the borders, we're not talking about Canada, and we're talking about a kind of racialization of Mexican immigrants that is part of a long history of criminalizing non-whites, right, which really begins with emancipation and the end of slavery, when black people who are not enslaved become dangerous because they're free. And so there's a whole history that's being invoked here. I mean, the worry about drugs, I would have loved a little bit of discussion about oxycodone. I mean, big pharma is not a discussion,
yeah.
Right? I mean, so in other words, it's both what he's saying and what he's not saying that work together to reinforce some very insidious racial and other hierarchies.
You know, to be perfectly honest, in listening to the president's speech, there were points of it which I found pretty compelling and interesting. You know, his call for infrastructure, his call to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, et cetera. But ultimately, after the hour and a half, I came away feeling that these were all sort of it was basically sugarcoating. What, you know, he probably believes that he genuinely wants these initiatives, so I'm going to grant him that. But sugarcoating around what was fundamentally a hard-hearted nativist vision for America, because the heart of it was his anti-immigration stance.
Right. And the other heart of it, too, was that, you know, we're going to be tough. We're going to be rigid. We're going to cut ourselves off. There was no sense of our relationship to the world. And so it was a kind of isolation that is often been about being afraid of other groups of people being a part of the United States, non-whites in particular. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think your reading there is right on.
Yeah. But on the other hand, also, I'm going to acknowledge that I feel like this is exactly what many Americans want. I mean, Steve Kornacki at NBC News wrote that President Trump, quote, was a culture warrior as a candidate, and he's a culture warrior as a president. Maybe deep down, that's exactly what 46.4% of Americans want. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, you know, there's no question that one of the things that he's been very successful at achieving is the kind of taking the lid off of the deep cultural changes around sexism and about racism and homophobia that the civil rights movement, the queer rights movement, and the women's rights movement were so important in facilitating. So the goal here was to make some long-term changes for diversity, for inclusion, for egalitarianism for everybody. And there, that produced resentment for whites, particularly white straight men, but not only them, and working class ones. There's resentment that those others were being allowed to impinge on their space. So he has been able to take that kind of sentiment and just made it completely emotionally and socially acceptable to say things in public that we were working to end as part of the public culture. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense that he's doing this profound work of emotional confirmation of some well-established, sometimes unconscious, forms of bias that are critical to the formation of the U.S. nation state. Mm-hmm. So it's very disturbing to see that these things are being influentially top-down expressed in irresponsible ways. So, I think this question of, like, what do people want? Like, are people just expressing what they already believe? This presumes that we're not in the business of being shaped and that our ideas are not being reinforced or solidified by media, by education and the like. So I see human beings as, and Americans obviously specifically, as being much more changeable, right? So this is hardening something that has been going on for a long time rather than encouraging a kind of egalitarian democracy mm-hmm. with an attentive sort of process.
Yeah. So that emotional confirmation that you're talking about, I mean, is he emotionally confirming or affirming this desire for, I guess, people are going to get mad at me, but I'm going to just say it, a form of white authoritarianism, right? I mean, his posture is all about it's male, it's militaristic, it's macho. I mean, that's actually
right.
I got to give a hat tip to the New York Times. I borrowed that language from them. But I mean, is that what he's affirming?
Yeah, that's a very significant part of it. Look, you know, one of the things that big corporations in collusion with government has done for the past 40 or 50 years or more is just gut the working class, gut the middle class, and all of the policies that Republicans and Democratic administrations put in place to nurture as much opportunity as possible. So as that's been receding, you know, white working class members who themselves don't understand themselves as racially being targeted, they only see themselves as class being targeted, they're very vulnerable to participating and sort of identifying with this, even though all the policies are working against them. But it gives them emotional, or what Du Bois, the great black sociologist, called the wages of whiteness, so that there's a kind of whiteness as a value in and of itself. And the masculinity of it, the toxic heteronormative masculinity, is staggering. Mm. I mean, it's a lot of what I think has, you know, turned the tide for women, some of whom see themselves as feminists, for really standing up for women in a broader way for the first time in a very long time.
But I wonder what you make of this. I mean, we're talking about President Trump as a deeply divisive figure in American politics. But, you know, that word divisive, for the entire duration of the two Obama administrations, people on the right frequently said Barack Obama is the most divisive president of in American history. I mean, just reflect with me on that maybe it's just a different side of the political spectrum right now that's feeling the edge of the division.
Well, you know, I actually, what I see as divisive is not only the policy initiatives, but the kinds of language and approach and the incapacity to emphasize the value of facts, right? So what – it's sort of a cauldron of forces that are coming together. We've always been divided politically in a lot of ways, but the notion that you could catch someone in a lie or have some fundamental – you know, values, moral values, ethical values, truth-telling values that were supposedly shared across the political spectrum was a uniting force. We literally have no consequences for the buckets full of extraordinary lies and just inventions that come up every day. No one can keep up. So it's not only emotional confirmation, it's also that factual content is literally no longer a gotcha. So you can say, here are the 10 lies that were told, and we move on.
Yeah.
It's literally. Have you seen any consequences? I mean, it's not even, you don't even have to say, oh, I got it wrong. There's no like right, wrong, whatever, right? So this makes for total polarization because it means all that's left is emotional confirmation. So you're either telling me what I want to hear or you're telling me what I don't want to hear. Facts don't matter.
Professor Rose, one last question for you. I mean, this has been a really interesting conversation, but I also admit I brought a little bit of pessimism to it in terms of my feeling about sort of the culture writ large over the past year. But I remind myself, America is a massive country. It's diverse, right? I mean, maybe we're underestimating the resilience of this cultural fabric that we're talking about. And so with that in mind, like as you look forward to this coming year, this 2018 that we're in, what do you look forward to?
Well, you know, I do think that one of the things that he's been able to do is not so much divide people as much as inspire a whole generation of young people and of a variety of racial and ethnic and sexual and, you know, immigrant, non-immigrant backgrounds to really get active at every level. So the few things that super inspire me are, one, the numbers of, you know, extremely diverse first-time political office candidates who are literally challenging the extraordinary white male stronghold on governance, with gender, with sexuality, with transgender candidates and others. It's just a groundswell. That's one. The second one is this second year of the Women's March, which was bigger than the first. You know, that is super inspiring. And the third is, you know, Black Lives Matter and the not only as a grassroots movement, which is brilliant and growing, but its diversification and net neutrality and Color of Change and other organizations that are beginning to work together to really create, you know, formidable challenges. The Me Too movement is obviously critical for women. I would consider that part of the Women's March. But these kinds of activities and actions are massive, and mm-hmm. I'm extremely hopeful that they'll expand and create more, not just opportunity, but fairness and restore some opportunities and fairness for everybody.
Well, Tricia Rose is director of Brown University's Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Professor Rose, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Magna. Take care.
Well, let's take a look now at the international implications of what President Trump said last night in his State of the Union address. For example, here's the president laying out his view of America's role on the world stage.
Around the world, we face rogue regimes, terrorist groups, and rivals like China and Russia that challenge our interests, our economy, and our values. In confronting these horrible dangers, we know that weakness is the surest path to conflict, and unmatched power is the surest means to our true and great defense.
Well, joining me now is James Stavridis. He's the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a retired admiral as well, who served as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe. He's with us today from Australia via Skype. Dean Stavridis, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always great to be with you, Magna.
I hope the weather down there is treating you better than we've got up here. But first of all, let me just ask you, the president's State of the Union address last night seems very heavy on domestic policy. There was some foreign policy, but what did you make of it?
Exactly as you say, I was actually very surprised to hear so little about our allies, our partnerships around the world. And indeed, he was probably 90% plus, maybe even a bit higher on domestic policy. Understandable that he wants to push those kinds of issues. But let's face it, it's a big world out there. It's got both opportunity and challenges. I was here in Australia, and the Australians I've spoken with were disappointed that there was no real feel for the world other than perhaps as a bit of a threat.
Interesting, because the words for example, multilateral, alliance, human rights, Europe, none of that came up in his speech.
Indeed. And I'll tell you a couple other big misses from my perspective. One is climate, which I continue to believe is a major security challenge, as well as an obvious global challenge.
But James, if I could just jump in here, I mean, could we realistically expect the president to talk at all about climate? I mean, he pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accords.
He did. And I object to that not only on the climate piece, Magna, but also on the global leadership piece. Yeah. That's what's really concerning. So nothing on climate, nothing on cyber, a global challenge, nothing on anything having to do with trade agreements broadly negotiated. Again, he pulled us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but the overall State of the Union just was a walk away from global U.S. leadership. That's very concerning.
Yeah. Well, I was looking at Ross Douthat from the New York Times, and his take was, quote, apart from the Islamic State, North Korea, and Guantanamo Bay, the foreign policy section was strikingly empty. America first, he says, it seems, means not having to bore viewers by bringing up anything about the world beyond our shores. All right. But let's talk about what he did say about North Korea, because I want to get your take on this, Dean Stavridis. The president did say that the United States is waging a campaign of maximum pressure against the North Korean regime.
Past experience has taught us that complacency and concessions only invite aggression and provocation. I will not repeat the mistakes of past administrations that got us into this very dangerous position.
Your reaction to that?
It's good to put pressure on North Korea, and we should be doing that in concert with allies, partners, and friends, and we should be pushing China to help us build sanctions and continue the pressure to drive them to the negotiating table. What I worry about is a lot of back-channel conversation about taking a preemptive strike option. This is sometimes called the bloody their nose option.
Right.
I worry deeply that that could lead to escalation. And by the way, Magna, we still have no U.S. ambassador in South Korea. Also very worrisome. I feel we're drifting toward a military option, and that is not where we want to be with North Korea.
I mean, to that point, Dean Stavridis, in the Washington Post today, Victor Cha, who had been the administration's pick to be U.S. ambassador to South Korea, wrote that, in his view, a preemptive strike against North Korea would not achieve the goal of nuclear disarmament. I mean, the very same view that I think lost him the position of ambassador.
That's exactly right. And he is correct. Because of our inability to control escalation, once we take a shot at North Korea preemptively, it would be the wrong move. And I hope the administration does not go there.
So I have to wonder how America's allies around the world really look at a speech like this. And let's examine that question through the lens of one particular portion. And it's where the president mentioned that the United States government recognition of when it recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And he said that following that, many countries in the United Nations passed a non-binding resolution. In fact, more than 190 countries voted for this non-binding resolution. Calling on other countries not to also recognize Jerusalem as the Israeli capital. And here's what the president said.
In 2016, American taxpayers generously sent those same countries more than $20 billion in aid. That is why tonight I am asking Congress to pass legislation to help ensure American foreign assistance dollars always serve American interests and only go to friends of America, not enemies of America.
So that was well received by portions of the chamber last night, but internationally, how does that sound?
Sounds very badly, because we give foreign aid not to reward our friends. We do it to change the minds of those who are not our enemies, but those who we want to influence. And this is really part and parcel of the administration's general war on diplomacy, war on the State Department. We've seen plummeting applications of young people to join our foreign service. And here's the point, Magda, this is not big money. This is very targeted resources that can avoid conflict, avoid war, create real deterrence. So this is a mistake. And it is also why, if you look at approval ratings of this administration of the United States globally, they've roughly been cut in half from over 50% to now around 30% approval. This is not a good position for the United States, and it's going to, again, force us to rely more on the military instrument, less on diplomacy. That's not a good place for the country to be headed.
Yeah. Well, James Stavridis, you're in Australia today talking to us. I really appreciate you doing that. But you mentioned a little bit earlier in the beginning of our conversation that you were talking to folks there about their reaction to the president. I mean, tell us more. What are people internationally saying?
They are concerned above all about unpredictability, and they see the disconnect between our policies as they are enacted on the ground and what comes out in tweets. Here's a practical example. And here in Australia, they worry because it's a Pacific country,
right,
very much about North Korea. So they worry when they see the president tweeting to the Secretary of State, as he did about a month ago, "Hey, stop wasting your time on diplomacy, Rex." At the same time, we're talking about a bloody the nose option. All of that is disconnected and very concerning. And I think that's a real takeaway. Lastly, you mentioned the wall in one of your earlier conversations. Look, we need to control our border. Got it. But here's a newsflash, Magna. You can build a 30-foot wall across 2,000 miles. Right to the left of the wall is an ocean. You're not going to be able to simply cut off that border. And it gives a terrible diplomatic feel to those nations to the south. Those are the kind of things that concern people internationally.
Well, James Stavridis is the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's also a retired admiral and former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, joining us today via Skype from Australia. James Stavridis, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thanks a lot, Magna. Talk again soon.
We'll be back. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, we've been following the controversial decision by the Baker administration to pick Eversource Energy and Hydro-Québec as the sole recipient of a multi-billion-dollar state clean energy contract. The Northern Pass project will run almost 200 miles of transmission line from Canada down through New Hampshire and could provide Massachusetts with 17% of the state's energy load when it comes online. But controversial, I said, because Eversource helped write the request for bids per state law, by the way. It also judged the bids and won with its own bid, even as Eversource's Northern Pass project still lacks a key permit in the Granite State. So that's why there's significant interest in what's happening in New Hampshire now. The state's Site Evaluation Committee has begun final discussions on whether or not to grant the Northern Pass its final essential permit. And joining us now with more is New Hampshire Public Radio's Annie Ropeek. She's been attending these meetings, and she joins us from Concord, New Hampshire. Annie, it's great to talk to you.
Hi, Magna.
So first of all, there have been a lot of hearings and testimony prior to this final set of hearings. So bring us up to speed. What has the Site Evaluation Committee been trying to base its decision on?
So they are going over 70 days of testimony that they got from experts and stakeholders and neighbors and people from Eversource. And that's on top of years of comments and other, you know, sort of documents that they've compiled to basically tell them everything they need to know about this project on both sides of the issue. And now they are going through that and trying to figure out if the project has proven that it passes certain tests. And so those are basically based around its financial stability and technical stability. Like, can Eversource get it done and run the thing without, you know, having it shut down in a couple of years and mess everything up again? And then they also need to try to decide if it basically benefits New Hampshire more than it costs it. So, you know, what is the impact to tourism and aesthetics? What is the impact to jobs and local economies and to traffic and local development plans and all of those things? So it's a big job. They have a ton of material that they're wading through and kind of pulling things out of appendices of things to try to remember what's going on, you know, months ago or years ago.
Okay.
To make this decision.
So, but it's, so as you say, it's like a complex but critically important decision, right? Because they have to gauge the import. They have to gauge about the impact in New Hampshire, but it's all based on a decision that was made in Massachusetts. So, are they talking about Massachusetts at all in this?
Yeah, it's really interesting. That technically happened after the official record was closed in this, so some people were not sure if it was going to come up. It has come up both days I've been to. That was today and yesterday, but they don't even really seem sure what they're allowed to do with it or what it would mean if they could consider it. So, you know, it has some effects on existing federal agreements that the project already had. You know, it changes the financials a little bit, and they're pretty confident the financials are sound. So it doesn't sound like that's going to change much. One really interesting question they came to today was about sort of how this affects the grid in New England and whether, you know, Massachusetts picking a different project would have had the same effect on the grid but not an effect on New Hampshire. And so what does it mean now that it's confirmed that it's definitely happening because of this if we give it a permit, and that it's us, you know, that it's happening here in New Hampshire? So we had Catherine Bailey and Christopher Way. They're two of the site evaluation committee members kind of trying to hash that out today. Let's listen to that.
Is there a downside to New Hampshire as a result of the RFP, of the RFP being awarded to the project?
Well, I think that's what we're here to figure out.
And that really didn't go much of anywhere, honestly. They were like, well, we don't really know. And so they're going to spend the next many days trying to figure it out as best they can. And they'll have to make a decision in the end. So
yeah,
we'll see how it factors in.
Now, this is really interesting. Okay, so before we get too far, I do want to ask you, I mean, there has been, correct me if I'm wrong, but there has been considerable opposition to Northern Pass in New Hampshire, from on-the-ground opposition from residents and even some towns, right?
Yes, that's right. So most of the comments, I think the vast majority of the written comments they got were in opposition. A bunch of towns signed Warren articles, you know, opposing the project years ago. There have been petitions. There's also been some support, especially from the people who would benefit economically, you know, would get the jobs to build it, would get to supply it, would live in towns where the tax revenue would be a big shot in the arm. But there really has been vocal opposition from neighbors, people who are worried about, you know, seeing the towers in their backyards or seeing the towers in White Mountain National Forest and seeing the line be buried there, and what that's going to do to tourism in our North Country and to the sort of aesthetics of the place. And
did those folks show up for the meeting, for the,
yeah,
the site committee meeting?
Yeah. There were a lot of them there yesterday and a lot of the supporters as well. Not so many here today. It's kind of petering out a little bit already, but I did talk to some of them yesterday, including Lisa Cutler. She's from this tiny town called Easton that's on the project's route. She was there with her husband, and she said they've been following it for years. Here's what she said.
It's not necessary. It's for profit. It's not in the public's interest. The public has demonstrated that they don't want it.
And I mean, that pretty much sums up their arguments. You know, they're really worried about kind of why we're doing this to a part of the state that supports so much tourism and just the natural character of the state, and they don't want to see it go
yeah.
through.
Now, I want to recognize that we are here in the middle of the thicket of government capital project permitting, so it can get a little wonky and a little confusing, but I want to clarify something because this just seems so fascinating to me, that in order for the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee to make a decision on this final key permit for Northern Pass, they have to kind of evaluate the economic costs or benefits to New Hampshire. Part of that relies on knowing what happens in Massachusetts regarding energy contract negotiations, but those contract negotiations are not complete by any stretch of the imagination. So how can they make their decision up in New Hampshire?
Yeah, that's right. So what they have is a bunch of hypotheticals, and they actually went through some of those today that they talked about kind of, okay, different pieces of testimony laid out different scenarios for what might happen in the Massachusetts decision, which we now know what has happened. So they kind of were trying to square that with what they had in testimony and approach it that way because it's not part of the official record. They're not collecting new information, new testimony, and they're not going to. And so they basically said, well, this means to us that it's definitely happening and that it will have this clear economic impact to the grid, or one that we can kind of estimate, and we know it's going to happen here to us in New Hampshire. So what does that mean? And their job really still comes – for them, it sounds like they think it still comes down to the physical impacts really of the thing and the job impacts. Not so much the grid impacts. They sound a little leery of trying to work out those details because they really don't have them yet, as you said.
Okay. So last question, Annie. It sounds as if this is not necessarily a done deal in Concord. Eversource and Northern Pass say they want to be up and running by 2020. Do you think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. So, there's a lot of skepticism that they can get it done. I think that if Eversource, gets the green light to get a shovel in the ground, that they'll make it happen. But that's the big question. And the SEC is currently standing in the way of that. And even if they approve the project, there's more than likely going to be an appeal. Or if they deny the project, Eversource will appeal. And if the SEC doesn't want to rehear the thing, then that would go straight to our state Supreme Court, which is, a months or longer process. And if Eversource wants to reapply with a different project or if they need to meet certain conditions that may be extensive or very serious, that could delay them even longer. And they're already, according to the SEC's calculations, going to be building 100 feet a day at their ideal timeline. So we'll see how that goes.
Ideal. Okay. And the SEC Annie's referring to there is the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee, which has to make a decision on the final important permit for Northern Pass to be constructed in the Granite State. Annie Ropeek is a reporter with New Hampshire Public Radio. Great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Meghna. Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And you know how CNN has those countdown timers to, like, whenever there's a major event, like 2 days
oh,
and
yeah.
27
oh, yeah.
seconds to State of the Union or presidential debate?
Barcelona FC has one for 4 days before the game starts. It says 4 days, 12 hours, 16 minutes, and 11 seconds until Barcelona takes the field
again. So should we have one? Is there a radio version for a countdown to the Super Bowl?
I don't think it's necessary, Meghna, because everybody knows. It's programmed. They don't need a clock. Yeah, it's in the air.
Or their phones are buzzing every
Super
hour.
It's the Super Bowl!
Well, Bill's here to talk with us about the coming Super Bowl. And also with us today from Minneapolis is Shira Springer, WBUR sports and society reporter. Hello, Shira. Do you have a countdown clock?
There's no countdown clock near me at this point. But, I think it's pretty obvious what's going on here.
Because, it's superfluous.
Exactly. I was going to say parking prices are jacked up and, it's just kind of all these roads are closed off downtown. I think people are clued in that there's a big game happening.
Maybe.
Sunday.
Yeah. Yeah. OK. So, Shira, let's just get the actual sort of sports analysis here. How are the Patriots looking in Minnesota?
Well, we don't actually get to watch them practice, but, from everything you see at media availabilities and from, the way they hammed it up on opening night, they look good. I mean, they look like a team that's been here before, been here last year. They know what to expect. They know how to handle the distractions. This is old hat for them in some respects, although they do kind of, each player, I think, tries to pick out a way to make this year special. But it really has a feel of like, okay, been there, done that. Let's get to business.
Okay, this year special. Well, here's what Pat's head coach Bill Belichick said at a media availability yesterday about his many trips to the Super Bowl.
They're all good. They're all special, and they're awfully hard to. This is a hard place to get to. You gotta meet all the competition. You gotta find a way to withstand it and battle through it. And so it's a great feeling to be here.
Bill, I think that's the most voluble I've heard Bill Belichick in some time.
Sounded downright animated. Almost.
Your thoughts about this?
He knows he needs to play along when he's out here just to kind of grin and bear it and get through it. And he does loosen up just a little bit.
Shira, you're on site, so I'm going to ask you a question based on something that I read earlier this week. Everybody knows that billions of dollars are bet on the Super Bowl, and some of the money is bet on some really weird propositions. They're called prop bets. I actually saw one that there were odds on what color cutoff shirt Belichick would wear when he came onto the sideline for the Super Bowl. Would it be gray? Would it be dark blue? Is this true?
So you want my expertise for
yes,
this?
I want to know if you've seen money changing hands on the prop bet regarding Bill Belichick's cutoff shirt.
Okay, so no, I haven't seen money changing hands. If you're interested, all of the bettors out there, I'd go with gray.
Go with gray, okay.
And I've seen other strange prop bets, like how many times will Trump's name come up in the broadcast? And, you know, will Mark Wahlberg's name come up in the broadcast?
I mean,
side bets come in all shapes and sizes.
What about Alexander Hamilton?
You never know. Hey, I would take that bet because I think one of the stars of Hamilton is singing America the Beautiful.
There you go.
I think that's the case.
All right.
So that seems like a sure bet to me.
Okay. So, like, yeah, my money's on that one and a gray shirt from Bill Belichick. But I want to play a little bit more tape here from Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. By the way, I mean, I know he has a lot of fans already, but I can officially now, finally, call myself a fan of his, not for anything that he's done on the football field, but for his defense of his little girl.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say you had purchased a pair of the pajamas that he sells with the special things, that ceramic discs that make you wake up stronger than when you went to sleep.
No, I'm just having my one glass of electrolyte-laden water instead.
Okay.
But, you know, I think he...
Are you paying like the $200 for that?
Oh, yeah.
No, I just add salt and sugar to a glass of water from the, from the fountain here. But, you know, I appreciated how he stood up for his daughter, and also in the wake of EEI saying terrible things about her, and also saying, hey, but that guy, God, I've forgotten his name already, but he didn't deserve to lose his job. So hats off to you, Tom Brady. But let's talk about it's as if he's on the show right now, but he's not. His hand injury
playing the part of Tom Brady.
Yeah, it is Bill Littlefield.
and never has anyone been miscast quite so gloriously badly.
Well, here's the actual Tom Brady talking about the injury he sustained on his hand before the AFC Championship game. He talked about it yesterday as well.
Of my hand, it's getting better. I mean, it's not quite where I want to be. So I'm just trying to protect it the best way I can. It's obviously a very important part of my body for a quarterback. So I just want it to be as healthy as possible for the game on Sunday.
Bill?
I'm going to throw it to Shira because she's there. Did you know before Tom Brady said that the hand was in fact an important part of a quarterback's body?
You know, Bill, I had an inkling that might be the case. and here's
I love the time before the Super Bowl. It's the best. Alice in Wonderland squared, man.
I just want everyone to know that we have two of the most serious and knowledgeable sports reporters and hosts anywhere on this show right now, in case you'd forgotten. Anyway, Shira, go ahead.
I was going to say, Bill, that's not the first time he's said that quote. So he keeps, you know, feeling he needs to educate the press corps about the fact of, you know, that his right throwing hand is a really important you know, his game.
Mm-hmm.
And for all those Patriots fans who might be concerned about whether the cut that he suffered in practice, I think it was exactly 2 weeks ago today, will affect him during the game, the answer is no.
Good.
Let's be honest. It didn't affect him during the AFC Championship game. He will be fine. Everything will be fine. I just can't wait for him to stop wearing the gloves during media availability, because it's really strange to see a man walk into, you know, like a 70-degree room wearing gloves.
I don't know. Michael Jackson did it, and
it was
the bomb.
Only one.
So, only one. That's true. But let's talk about a more serious kind of injury, that concussions. Just quickly, Shira, do we know if Rob Gronkowski is going to play?
It certainly looks like it. I mean, he was at an event, a sort of a public appearance, a promotional appearance, in fact, last night. And he was asked, do you think you're going to play in the Super Bowl? And he goes, yeah. It seems like it's only a matter of time. It's when, not if, he'll get cleared by both the team physician and the independent neurological consultant that needs to clear him. So all signs are pointing toward yes. And I would think we'd see, you know, him at full contact practice, you know, before the end of the week.
Yeah, and Roger Goodell, NFL commissioner, gave his annual State of the NFL address today. He talked about concussions. What did he say?
Well, he talked about, you know, basically that he tries to make the game safe, that they're, you know, they're trying to make sure that every player gets proper medical care. So, I mean, it was kind of what you'd expect the commissioner to say.
Can I just jump in here and say that anybody who thinks that somebody who suffered a concussion 2 weeks ago is getting proper medical care if they get back on the field is nuts.
Shira?
There's a lot of noise.
It's nuts to say that anybody who suffered a concussion 2 weeks ago is getting proper medical care
if he's cleared to go
back onto the field.
It's interesting. I think nuts in the sense that he's going back to play an incredibly violent game where he's certain to get his head, you know, hit again or be hit again.
Without any doubt.
And with that being said, I did talk to some neurologists
yesterday.
Sorry,
we got 10 seconds here, so I'm going to tell folks that they should stay tuned and they'll hear more from you in the coming days about this. Shira Springer, WBR Sports and Society reporter, speaking to us from Minneapolis. Thanks, Shira.
Thanks for having me.
And Bill Littlefield, it's always great to have you.
Thank you, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.